John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're going to talk about the growing influence of the private, for-profit prison industry in America. Private prisons are now a multi-billion dollar business in the United States and a powerful voice in the halls of legislative bodies, both state and federal. The industry has invested millions of dollars in both direct campaign contributions and in lobbying, all with very little scrutiny. Today on the Kathleen Dunn Show, we'll hear from a pair of guests who will shed some light on this issue. Michael Cohen is a freelance writer and journalist covering politics, hip-hop, and social justice. His article in the Washington Post headlined, "How For-Profit Prisons Have Become the Biggest Lobby No One Is Talking About," caught our attention. Michael Cohen, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Also joining me today is Paul Ashton, Development and Research Associate at the Justice Policy Institute. He's the author of Gaming the System, How the Political Strategies of Private Prison Companies Promote Ineffective Incarceration Policies. Paul Ashton, thanks for joining us today on the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, Paul Ashton, let's start with you. Just how big is the private prison industry in America? How many prisons are we talking about? How many inmates?
Sure. It's a pretty big industry. We're looking at an industry that pooled in 2014 over $3.3 billion in revenue, and in 2014 housed approximately 131,000 people in for-profit private prisons across the country, which is about 8.4% of the people incarcerated.
Okay, so are most of these state prisons, federal? Who's using them?
That's a great question. So about 91,000 out of the 131,000 are people who are housed in states, who are housed by states and for-profit prisons, and about 40,000 are part of the federal system.
Okay. Michael Cohen, who are the major players here, and what kind of lobbying effort are we talking about?
Well, the two biggest players would be GEO Group and Corrections Corporations of America, CCA. In total, they've, you know, funneled more than $10 million to candidates since 1989. And really, what I was focusing on is kind of the strange alliances, you know, between staffers and the candidates and politicians once they're in office. And also, there's the whole revolving door effect, how you have staffers going back to the lobbying firms after, you know, lobbying firms have profited, you know, pretty handsomely from, you know, lobbying for GEO Group. Primarily, mm-hmm. That's what I focused on in my piece. But,
okay. Well, give us some examples of that.
Well, there's Cesar Conda, who I write about quite a bit in the piece. He was tapped as Marco Rubio's chief of staff once Rubio won the Senate seat. And he was actually a co-founder of what is now GEO Group's top lobbying firm, Navigators Global. At the time when he first joined Rubio's staff, he was receiving payments of, I believe it was up to $150,000 as part of a stock buyout arrangement. In April 2014, he went on to lead one of Rubio's PACs, the Reclaim America PAC, and subsequently GEO became a top 10 contributor to that PAC. And once he left Rubio's staff, now he's back with Navigators. And to be fair, there's a good degree of separation. You, as I do mention, you can't necessarily find that quid pro quo, but it's just kind of alarming, the close ties that the lobbying firm has to someone who is influencing policy.
Well, what are these companies looking for in terms of policy? What kinds of initiatives have they supported? How does that manifest itself at state and federal levels in terms of actual laws or actual incarceration policies?
Well, what they're looking for is quite obvious because they're drafting the legislation some of the times. The controversial immigration law that was passed in Arizona, that was model legislation proposed by ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, and it was, you know, basically a CCA lobbyist drafting the legislation that was going to be adopted in Arizona. Something similar even happened in Wisconsin with, I believe it was Alec proposed model legislation to have prisoners shipped out of state to private facilities because private prisons are actually banned in Wisconsin. And Scott Walker actually voted for that while he was in the state house.
Paul Ashton, your report outlines a three-pronged approach to increase profits for these companies through political influence, lobbying, direct campaign contributions, and building relationships and networks. Expand on those a little bit. How are they achieving their power?
Sure. I think you did a great job at outlining what we term the triangle of private prison political influence, and that is for them to get more money, they need to implement these strategies. So in terms of campaign contributions, it's the idea that they're giving directly to political campaigns to curry favor with not only current lawmakers, but people who are running for office who will ultimately have decision-making authority over their contracts. Lobbying, we know that over the last 16 years, both CCA and GEO have spent over $26 million in lobbying the federal government alone. And they're lobbying on bills that deal with appropriations for the Department of Justice and for Homeland Security. They're lobbying on bills like the Private Prison Information Act, which would require them to be subject to FOIA. And lastly, the idea of relationships and associations is really what Michael was talking about, tapping into the idea of the revolving door between public and private interests, that it is essential for these companies to bring in people who have strong ties and strong networks within government and legislators and legislations across the country so that they can push their agendas and their business model and their interests and ultimately get more contracts, because what we're talking about here are government contracts.
Yeah, and Michael Cohen, one of the things that jumped out at me when I was looking into this is the idea of quotas, because I think this might surprise some of our listeners. You write that private prison contracts often require the government to keep the correctional facilities and immigration detention centers full, forcing communities to continuously funnel people into the prison system, even if actual crime rates are falling. So how many prisons require these guaranteed occupancy rates? I know that was a problem in Arizona.
I'm pretty sure every contract is going to have some sort of occupancy rate. And I don't know the exact number of how many have them or if any don't. I know most of them do have them. They're almost always above 90%. And, you know, like I said, the thing that strikes you as absurd is even when it goes as high as 100%, as it did in Arizona.
And so if these quotas aren't met, then the state has to pay for the empty beds. Is that it?
Yes, that's correct.
And there have actually been some lawsuits filed by private companies against states in order to force them to fill these beds or to pay for them?
That's not something I'm particularly aware of.
Okay.
It can certainly happen. To the best of my knowledge, that the state is going to pay for the beds, whether the beds are empty or full.
Okay.
So it's not necessarily that they're going to make sure that they find enough quote-unquote lawbreakers to fill the beds, but they're going to get paid. You know, the company is going to get paid one way or the other.
I'd like to invite our listeners to weigh in on this issue at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. And we have privately in Wisconsin, just to kind of clarify that a little bit, and maybe my producers can take a look into this. My understanding is that we do have some prisons in the state, at least one that I know of, that was privately constructed. It may not be operated by a private company, but I think it was leased to the state. I drive by it on Highway 29 every time I go through Stanley. Anyway, I'm just wondering what our listeners think about the idea of private prison owners having influence over policy connected to how they make their money. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or find us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. So, Paul Ashton, let's talk about trends we've seen in terms of incarceration rates in the last couple of decades. I mean, we see stories saying that the United States has the most people in prison of pretty much anybody in the world, and yet crime statistics suggest that crime's actually going down. So what's the trend here in terms of incarceration?
That is a great question. And indeed, what we've seen over the last three decades is a skyrocketing in the number of people we put in prison across this country. We have, as of 2014, had about 2.2 million people who are incarcerated across our country, both in jails and federal and state prisons. But what we've seen since about 1992, 1993 is a consistent decline in both violent and property crime across this country. And so we've kind of seen these conflicting trends that we are seeing less crime across the country and putting more and more people in prison.
And how is that happening? Is that just we hear some talk about, well, we've got mandatory sentencing and things like that. How are we ending up putting more people in prison if there is, in fact, less crime?
You know, it all kind of dates back to the 1980s and the 1990s when we had this really strong tough-on-crime mentality, and we were passing all sorts of laws that, as Michael mentioned, CCA and GO participated in working on ensuring got passed across the country through ALEC, like mandatory minimums, truth in sentencing laws, really focusing on the drug war and putting more people behind bars related to the drug war. And that kind of really spiked the population from the 80s through the 90s until present day. And it wasn't until maybe 5 or so years ago that really the idea of comprehensive criminal justice reform kind of hit the national dialogue to where we are today.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, Michael Cullen, I would like you to address the issue of the impact of all of this on immigration, because there seems to be a real connection there, and you alluded to it earlier. I want you to expand on that when we return. We'll also hear more from Paul Ashton, and we're starting to get some phone calls. We'll take your calls and emails and Facebook posts and comments as well. Still room for you to get in at 800-642-1234. If the line's busy, send us an email or put your post up on Facebook, and we'll share it that way. We're talking about the private for-profit prison lobby in this country. It's gotten pretty powerful in a hurry, and with almost no one noticing. Well, we're paying attention today and wondering what you think about this situation. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, it's the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn, and we're talking about the private for-profit prison industry in the United States. It's become a pretty significant lobbying voice. Lots of political contributions, lots of money spent trying to influence public policy, and almost no one has noticed this. Well, we're noticing it today. Freelance writer Michael Cullen, whose article was the genesis for this program, is with us, as is Paul Ashton with the Justice Policy Institute. You are also involved in this discussion. Let's go to the phones. James is with us first in Lake Geneva. Hello, James.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I worked in the Department of Corrections for over 25 years, and I've got some insight on it. I'm a very educated guy. On paper and otherwise, you get a lot of life education. But your guess, one thing these private prisons do is some of them have the contracts nationally that they're paid whether there's somebody there or not. And the states just, you know, they don't want to see an empty bed because they're paying for nothing, so they push people in there. That's what it's about. It's not so much that they're getting paid, you know, to have people in there. But when you start running a prison for profit and companies get in, you throw rehabilitation right out the window because it's a profit, it's a business, and the business is bad if they rehabilitate. There's no reason for them to try to turn these people around. Also, Governor Walker has been just slamming the prison system since he's been governor and before. part of that was because I believe he had family members owning quite a bit of stock in CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, when he was in the House or the legislature. Also, Mr. Walker has degraded the pay and benefits to practically nothing. And most of these officers, once they start in after their insurance payments and all these other payments, they're making about $12 an hour before taxes. So that's why they're having a very high turnover, and a lot of this happened since Walker got in, and I was one of the lucky ones. I got out just before he got elected because I knew he was getting in. But this is a long-term plan for the state of Wisconsin governor that we have now, is to make prisons so bad publicly that he can slip through and make them private to make money for these people. And I'll just wait for your comments, and I'll take them off the air. I'll say goodbye.
All right, James, thanks thanks for sharing those insights with us. Michael Cohen, Paul Ashton, what do you think about what James had to say?
I think James has made a lot. Sorry.
Well, Paul, you James go ahead. Made... Go ahead, Paul, and then Michael. We'll get both of you on this. Paul, you start.
I think James has made a lot of great points there, and some of the things that we talked about in gaming the system is really the idea that in order for these companies to make more money, they need to have people in their facilities, they need to have them stay there longer, and they ultimately need them to come back. They need to keep their beds full. And, you know, James has raised a lot of great points that some of the ways they're able to, quote-unquote, save states money is by cutting costs on their end, right? Which means not allowing unions, not allowing collective bargaining, not training staff or paying staff as well, not offering the same level of programs. So ultimately, they're not providing the same level of service that a public facility can.
Mm-hmm. Michael Cohen?
Well, I mean, just to piggyback off what Paul was saying, it's they might think they're saving money by, you know, cutting the quality of services that they provide, but then, you know, as a consequence, you have lawsuits, and then you have the state has to spend money on additional oversight and, you know, come up with ways to regulate the flaws in the way the private prison operates. So, there are conflicting studies, but for the most part, it really doesn't show a significant savings.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that your caller alluded to is how they don't necessarily have to meet the quota as long as the state pays for the empty bed. But, you know, one thing that we do need to look at is how the mass incarceration kind of coincides with the deindustrialization and, you know, a lot of jobs lost. So in an economy where there's almost three applicants for every available job, like what do you do with a disposable population, which might sound a bit outlandish, but when you look at the actual trends in mass incarceration in the job market, it makes some sense.
Mm. Well, that's very disturbing. Michael Cohen, I alluded to this before the break. The system as it stands, and reading your article, the system as it stands seems to disproportionately affect immigrants who are in the U.S. illegal. Is that a fair assessment?
Privatization, private prison.
Right.
I'm not sure if it's disproportionate, but there's definitely a shift away from because these companies, they see that there's a lot, you know, the reform in the whole criminal justice part, so they're looking to criminalize immigration even more.
Well, I guess I was referring to a statistic that I've got here on the screen. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention budget includes a mandate from Congress that at least 34,000 immigrants remain detained on a daily basis, a quota that has steadily grown each year, even as the undocumented immigrant population in the United States has leveled off. Private prisons have profited handsomely from that policy, owning 9 of the 10 largest ICE detention centers, according to a report released this month by Grassroots Leadership. I guess that's kind of what I'm talking about. There's a federal quota for the number of beds, and most of those are going to private companies. It would seem that immigration policy favors the private prison industry.
Yeah, that's certainly where the money is for them, and there's actually a great piece in The Nation, about this whole kind of, overlooked part, element of the justice system, where basically people, people who would cross the border illegally repeatedly, we used to deport these people. And as soon as the proliferation of private prisons came in the 1980s, we started detaining these people. And, you know, it's just a wildly fascinating piece that, you know, I probably need to read again, fully digest.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's, you know, like I said, these were people that were once deported and handled it in a different way. And when you're looking at prison as a profitable industry, you need to find new populations to fill the prisons. And right now, immigrants, sadly, are, you know, being singled out as that population. And
well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because that gives me a chance to do some shameless promotion here. We're actually going to talk about that very thing tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll have that journalist you referenced from The Nation, and we'll be talking about that article. So we will visit this issue tomorrow. I want to go back to the phones, though, and we've got a caller from Racine, Diana, who is with us. Diana? Hello. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Back in 1999, against the recommendation of the district attorney's office for probation, I was sentenced to 3 years of prison for issuance of worthless checks. 3 months later, all the medium security inmates were sent out to a private facility in Oklahoma. And despite the fact they knew that I was currently in a battle with the state trying to get my children out of foster care, and they were about to be returned to my home, but when the prison system decided to send me away to Oklahoma, my parental rights were terminated because on the basis of the fact that they said my children would not be allowed to see me since I was going to be sent out of state for 3 years. Now, the staff at that private facility brought in drugs. They brought in alcohol, and they catered to the needs of the inmates. And they specifically told us that the reason that they allowed this craziness was that as long as the inmates were kept happy and didn't complain to the state representatives or complain to the corrections in the state of Wisconsin, their contracts would be continued from year to year. There was no rehabilitation programs available. There was nothing being forced. Like, we're not said to say, you need to complete this program. It just was like willy-nilly craziness. Everybody was allowed to do whatever they wanted. As long as we were kept happy, we didn't complain, and our contracts were renewed.
Diana, thanks for sharing your story. Paul Ashton, is this something that you've heard about the private prison industry?
You know, we've seen a lot of, Michael alluded to this earlier, that one of the ways these companies have not been able to save states money is because there's a number of lawsuits that end up getting filed against the private prison companies. And there are examples that Diana gave, as well as the fact that we have facilities across the country that have been deemed like the Gladiator School, because there were such high levels of violence in the facility because of the inability of the private prison company to staff the facility in the way that it should have been staffed. We've seen instances across this country where judges have done a quid pro quo thing for getting cash for sending youth to private facilities. And so I think that there are a number of examples out there that support Diana's arguments that, you know, as best we try to make these facilities work in the system, you know, the money and the desire to increase revenue, I think, ultimately is on the backs of people who serve time in those facilities.
Let's go to Terry in Mineral Point next and get Terry's comment. Terry, go ahead.
Hello. Yeah, my news is about 30 years old, but I was involved with Guest and Ferry in bringing the first lawsuit against CCA for Wisconsin prisoners. I discovered that one of my appellate prisoners had been tortured there, and there was a disturbance, and they set in this SWAT team type of thing, jackbooted thugs, who just beat the hell out of the prisoners there trying to find out which guy had caused the problem. One of them, well, there was some torture that was kind of too gross to say on the radio, I think. But anyway, so we got involved with this lawsuit, and as we were investigating it, we discovered, much as Diane had just said, that the there was very little supervision in the prisons, that the prison guards apparently were very poorly paid, like minimum wage or shortly or just a little more, and they would sell drugs to the inmates. Some of them could hardly read. As a matter of fact, the inmates had to take over delivery of mail sentence service because the prisoners weren't literate enough to, I mean, the guards were not literate enough to do it. Anyway, mm-hmm. It sounded like a ridiculous system, but the governor at the time, Tommy Thompson, loved it.
Hmm. Terry, thanks for sharing your story. Michael Cohen, you want to comment on what Terry had to say and follow up on anything Paul said earlier about how these prisons actually work?
As far as about how the prisons actually work, it's mostly state level, and that kind of it helps them evade scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
The intricate connections that I detailed in my piece, that goes on, you know, as we said, in Wisconsin with Scott Walker. And, you know, it's just scary the way that they operate with, you know, the detention quotas. I mean, are you talking operate on a day-to-day basis or, you know?
Well, no, I just meant, you know, to comment on what our last two callers. I just wanted to give you a chance to jump in on that if you wanted to. We have a lot more callers to get to. There'll be a line opening for you soon at 800-642-1234. Michael Cohen, let's talk a little bit about maybe we make this a little more philosophical oriented discussion. The current system, with all of its political influence and quotas that you outline in your article, do you think, I mean, doesn't this run counter to what should be a rehabilitative mission for the criminal justice system? Isn't there a healthier version of incarceration we could be looking at?
Absolutely, and that's what I'm really looking to cover in a lot of my future work, is how do we get beyond, you know, our knee-jerk acceptance of the permanence of the prison as an institution, especially as it exists today. You know, it's quite disturbing that we can't come up with anything better than, you know, we just subject people to, you know, what are essentially torture chambers. You know, incarceration, and I'm paraphrasing Ta-Nehisi Coates, incarceration is a euphemism for what goes on inside of prisons. And it's pretty obvious that the system is mostly a failed system, and the profit motive is incentivizing the expansion of a failed system.
Mm-hmm.
Also, one other thing. I remember your callers was talking about being shipped to an out-of-state prison, and since you mentioned make this a little more philosophical, I'm making my way slowly through the Edward Baptiste book about slavery and capitalism, and he digs a lot into how much profit was made off of forced migration. And then when you look at the disproportion of people of color in prisons and just that kind of forced migration, and, you know, regardless of your caller's, race or ethnicity, she's being separated from her family, which is an essential part to rehabilitation, to sort of bring it back to what your initial question was.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're tearing families apart, companies are making profit off of it, and we're not rehabilitating the people who need help.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Laura in Milwaukee next. Laura, hello.
I want to talk about the school-to-prison pipeline. I was a scout leader for 20 years, and I was hearing, as a scout leader, about, you know, kids being arrested in grade school for school fights and kids losing driver's license and, you know, way back in grade school or junior high, you know, for truancy. Losing a driver's license before you even could get a driver's license. Now, that's called the prison pipeline. These are things that must be eliminated.
So, Laura's suggesting that the system we have kind of sets people up to end up in prison. I guess, Paul Ashton, maybe you could address this a little bit. I mean, we talked about how many actual prison beds are in private hands in this country. And it really isn't, I mean, compared to the number of people who are incarcerated, and I suppose we'd have to include city and county jails as well as state and federal prison facilities, just how big a slice of this pie is the private prison system when you look at the entire package? And don't we really have to look at the whole criminal justice system, which many people would say is badly malfunctioning?
Yes, I would first say that we need to look at the entire system. In terms of the for-profit private prison sector, it's about 8.4% of the current number of people incarcerated in this country. In 2014, we incarcerated over 2.2 million people in this country, and about 131,000 of them were in private prisons. So while it's a small slice of a larger pie, it's indicative of the significant problem we have and the addiction we have to incarceration in this country. And so I would agree with Laura that we need to take a substantial look and a broad sweeping look at entirely reforming our injustice system. You know, JPI did a report in 2011 called Education Under Arrest that really looked at the role of the school-to-prison pipeline and talked about the fact that having police officers in schools can actually help feed youth into the justice system from school. And so I would agree that we need to take a holistic look. I think that there have been times where people have talked and expanded it and called it a cradle-to-prison pipeline because we're not investing in communities that have a increased likelihood of being involved in the justice system. So really it goes back to how we're interacting with communities, how we're looking at public safety, and how we're investing in communities that are most at risk for being involved in the justice system.
Well, you know, that brings up an interesting point because I know I heard an education expert speak, and he basically said that the people who design and plan prisons take a look at fourth grade reading scores to determine how many prisons they'll need to build in the next 15 years. And so, you know, there's probably an education component here. It isn't just about judges and courts and police officers and criminals. There's a whole system that probably needs to be looked at. And we can certainly discuss that in the last 20 minutes or so of the program. We need to take a break. When we come back, we have more callers. I have about, 10 more pages of questions. We won't get to everything. We'll see if we can get to the most important stuff next. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Phone lines are full right now, so please go ahead and use Facebook or send an email to get your comment out there. We have Michael Cohen and Paul Ashton with us, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about the private prison lobby and how powerful it's become, almost with no one noticing. Well, Michael Cohen noticed and he wrote an article, and we're talking about that. Paul Ashton with the Justice Policy Institute is chiming in on his expertise on this system as well. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, it's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're talking about prisons, particularly private prisons, private for-profit prisons. The companies that own and run these prisons have become a very powerful lobbying force in both state and federal circles. We're talking about how that came to be and what some of the problems are, some of the danger signs that might go along with that. Michael Cohen, freelance writer who wrote the article that became the basis for today's program, and Paul Ashton with the Justice Policy Institute. They're both here. Michael Cohen, before we go back to the phones, I want to quote from your article. One line from your story. Well, I'll just read it. With the growing influence of the prison lobby, the nation is, in effect, commoditizing human bodies for an industry in militant pursuit of profit. Now, those are kind of strong words. I mean, they're a bit jarring. Do you think people see it this way? Should they?
I think well-informed people see it that way. I do think that most of us are conditioned from a very early age to not really care about prisons, what goes on in prisons, what policies, gave us the prison as an institution. That's why prisons are in remote places, out of state, out of mind. But, mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It's in effect what they're doing. Whether or not people see it that way, is difficult because there are mixed reactions to the article. Some people are like, wow, I didn't even know that we had a for-profit prison industry. And then there are some people who, you know, think this is just old news, which most of it is. You know, Paul's report was, what, 2011? A lot of the links in my story are old reporting that, I just pulled together.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, what about you? I mean, are we commoditizing human bodies?
Yes, we are. I mean, fundamentally, you know, in order for these companies to make money, they need to have people, and they need to have people in their prisons. They need to have them stay there longer and to come back. And so, yes, we're commoditizing people, and we're particularly decimating communities, and particularly poor communities of color when we're talking about the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Marty will be with us next from Woodstock. Marty, hello.
Good afternoon. Great topic. Let's address the elephant in the room. You need to fill beds in prisons. How do you do that? The gavel has to come crashing down and saying, you're guilty. There's no way you're going to tell me that these judges aren't on the take and not getting their hands greased in order to make this happen.
Marty, thanks for the call. There have been some instances, and Michael, you alluded to this earlier. There was a case in Pennsylvania where judges received millions in kickbacks from for-profit juvenile detention centers. But Marty is indicating maybe a much broader problem. Is this the case that judges are the ones responsible for filling these prisons, or is it mandatory sentencing laws that often tie the hands of judges?
Mandatory sentencing laws probably have a greater effect. I mean, you know, every few weeks you'll see a headline or an op-ed from a former judge or former prosecutor who, you know, didn't agree with the sentence that had to be handed down to, you know, some nonviolent drug offender.
Mm-hmm. There does seem to be some pretty excessive sentencing for what would be seem to be minor nonviolent offenses. Considering that private prisons are only about 8% of the total incarceration in this country, who else is benefiting from having all these people in jail? Where's the payoff here if you're not for the other 91% of the prison system that's owned by the federal or state governments, counties, cities? Paul Ashton, what's the payoff here for the politicians if the private prisons aren't the majority of this here?
That's a really good question. First and foremost, to tie in the private prisons, I would say part of the payoff is the fact that they're kicking in money for their campaigns and their reelection campaigns and that sort of thing. But to get to your larger point, we often talk about in criminal justice circles this idea of the prison industrial complex, that we have this massive system that makes money off of people in prison. And you're talking about people who work in facilities, people who provide services for facilities, including, you know, privatized healthcare, privatized food service, telephone service, all of these things. So there is a large, substantial industry that's beyond just a for-profit private prison that has monetary interest in people being incarcerated.
Okay. That makes sense. Let's go to the phones. And Rich is with us from Manitowoc. Rich, hello.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Go ahead.
I'm from Manitowoc County, and I'm familiar with the court system there. The question I have for Mr. Cohen is, and the comment I'm going to make is, it's a prioritized county jail system. By the time you get into the county jail system, the state jail system is just following through on whatever your previous caller said, the judge hammering down the gavel. But so what, in my opinion, from my experience, why on a county level, why is it prioritized? And there's so much damage being done to people with minor or offenses that are one time only that become part of the system and do not get out of it because of that one or two time mistakes they made.
Yeah, you've got people in for minor offenses, and it seems to be a real cycle in and out of prison. Michael Cohen, is that something that, as you've been looking into the prison system, and I want to get Paul Ashton on this as well, that's what's going on here? People start out with something small, and then it kind of snowballs?
Absolutely. I do think it's by design. Once you have a mark on your record, it's that much harder to get a job. If you're unemployed, it's that much harder to refrain from stealing or something like that. I'm kind of oversimplifying here, but, it's basic logic that the way in which we penalize people who break the law, it only pushes them, pushes them further to crime.
Mm-hmm. Paul Ashton?
I would totally agree with what Michael said. In addition to that, I would just add that the fact that we don't even have to necessarily talk about people who have been convicted of a crime. If you're arrested and you go and you serve time in jail and you can't afford bail to get out, the collateral consequences associated with that in and of itself, the fact that you could serve 3 days and sit in jail and lose your job or lose stable housing, and all of those things are more likely to lead you back into the justice system. And so really it's the culmination of collateral consequences that we're seeing that this system basically does. It sets people up to fail and sets them up to come back.
Let's go to another phone call. This time it'll be Fred, who's calling from Wisconsin. Fred, go ahead.
Hello. I taught in the Wisconsin prison system for 15 years. I found that most of the guards had at least gone through college or technical college. Most of them were quite motivated to do a good job. Anything that comes down where they're doing a poor job has basically come from the Wisconsin legislature and Scott Walker in the last 5 years. They've taken away any incentive to do a good job by cutting unions out and basically ruining morale for anyone that works in the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. They've just basically done a terrible job of ruining morale for anyone that works for the Department of Corrections, with teachers, with all state employees.
Mm-hmm. Fred, thanks. Thanks for the call. Paul Ashton, Michael Cohen, is this something that we see in other states as well, where fiscally conservative policies are causing morale to fall, wages to be cut, benefits and so forth? Is that a pattern we're seeing nationwide, or is Wisconsin kind of an outlier, do you think? Paul Ashton, I'll ask you that question.
I do not think Wisconsin is an outlier in any degree. One of the things that we've talked about in game system in particular is the fact that private prisons are successful in the arguments that we're making, that a number of people lose, taxpayers and communities, people who serve time in facilities, but ultimately the people who work and are employed by these facilities are losers in this game as well, because private prison companies don't allow unionization, they don't allow collective bargaining, they often don't provide the same level of training, they pay less, and have higher turnover rates, which means that the likelihood of increased conflict, the inability to negotiate conflict between people to do your job effectively, is all mitigated because of the policies and procedures of these private companies in order for them to turn over more revenue.
And your report, Paul Ashton, came out in 2011. How have things changed since then? Has the Citizens United ruling accelerated further problems?
That's a great question. In terms of giving from political action committees like CCA's Political Action Committee or GEO's Political Action Committee, we haven't seen in the past couple of years a substantial increase. They still give on average several hundred thousand dollars a year to federal candidates, to political parties and political action committees. So we haven't necessarily seen the extraordinary number of increase in contributions, but it means that it's an option, right? Mm-hmm. But I would also say that one of the reasons we haven't seen that just yet is because we haven't had enough pushback on the private prison companies that they need to employ that just yet,
sure.
Right? They're still garnering contracts throughout the government, throughout federal government with states across the country, and so they've been pretty successful, and they still maintain success. GEO, for instance, saw an increase in its revenue from 2013 to 2014, so mm-hmm. they're still being successful. I think once they get to the point where they're losing that success, they may move to really utilize the Citizens United ruling.
Let's go to Terry in Wisconsin next as our next caller. And Terry, go ahead.
Yes. My question was, to what extent do these private prisons versus public have, what percentage is of the population is white-collar crime versus the black minority immigrant, lower end spectrum of the population populating these private prisons? And I would suspect that because a comment made earlier that they're taking fourth grade reading scores to determine how many prisons, private prisons to build, would would correlate with the white collar crime, obviously has better reading scores and better legal representation or access to it, that they are not a big part of this private prison population. But I'll wait and take my answer.
Okay, Terry, thanks. Paul Ashton, speaking strictly of the private prison population, does it reflect the rest of the prison population, which seems to be rather heavily weighted toward minorities?
I would argue that it does. It's easier to look at that at the federal side, where we're looking at a large influence of immigration detainees being housed in federal prisons that are privately operated and run. You know, looking at the state level, it's a little more difficult. And one of the reasons is because private prison companies are not often subjected to Freedom of Information Act laws. It's one of the reasons why Congress has tried to push for a number of years the Private Prison Information Act that would require they're subject to FOIA. So it's hard to actually get that nitty-gritty data that would allow us to actually get the direct percentages of the people of who are of lower income or people of color who are residing in their facilities. But I would argue that it would mirror what we see nationally.
Okay. Let's try and get one more caller in here. David is in Madison. You'll have to be brief because we're almost out of time.
Thank you. I hope you do a follow-up on what's going on in Dodge County, Wisconsin, with the detention center for the immigration folks trapped in that. But my comment is the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 7, Clause 8, says that the U.S. Post Office should be instituted. And the point is government runs services. The services are there to be run by the government. They're not to be run as a business or to make a profit. And ever since Ronald Reagan came in and said the government's a problem, the Republican Party has run on that issue. And the privatization of corrections is simply one outgrowth of the idea that you got to run government as a business. Somebody's got to make a profit, rather than the idea ensconced in the Constitution that there are certain things that should be services, and government-run services, and
okay.
That they do have a cost, but their services are not a public and not a private entity for profit.
David, thanks. Thanks so much. And Michael Cohen, I'll give you the last word here because we're almost out of time. What can be done about the problem that you've identified in your article? What would you like to see happen?
As far as what can be done, I mean, it would be a huge, you know, complicated process. I guess one thing you need to do, Citizens United should be overturned. You know, I hate to sound like some kind of liberal broken record, but yes, we need to get money out of politics because that's obviously playing a big part. And I think that Bernie Sanders, he introduced a bill. I'm not sure what happened with it. It ever made to the floor to get a vote, but to phase out the private prison industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be one of the biggest steps towards criminal justice reform.
Okay.
You know,
And we'll have to leave it there because we're all out of time here. I really appreciate the both of you being on. Michael Cohen, Paul Ashton, thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You.
Michael Cohen and Paul Ashton join me today. Thanks to Scott Myers, who produced this hour of programming and booked these guests. KP Whaley handled on-air production. Michelle Good was our technical director this afternoon on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Tomorrow at this time, Ann Jones will join us to tell us why, after living in Norway, America seems kind of backwards to her. It'll be a crash course in what she calls social democracy. That's coming up tomorrow on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. Have a great afternoon.